Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday morning, Erev Shabbos. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Good morning to you.
Less traveling for you this Friday, unlike last Friday when you were in the hustle and bustle of getting from the airport.
Well, tomorrow night again, back to Israel and to Auschwitz on
Oh, that's right. You're part of the big Knesset ceremony on Monday.
Right. Speaking at the dinner there.
That is going to... I can't wait till next Friday to hear your review of that. I'm sure you're anticipating a very symbolic and very moving ceremony over there.
Well, it's an historic event. It's never been done. And you have the congressional delegation going, led by Eric Cantor, from the House, and you have people coming from all over Europe.
Well, the rumor still is that you're heading out early tomorrow, right after Shabbos, to escape the freezing conditions and get to the beautiful weather in Israel. That's what the rumor on the street is.
Warm up in Krakow, right?
Well, I didn't say Krakow is going to be like that, but a day or two of a respite in Jerusalem would be bad. I'll tell you that much.
I'll be in Israel for about 6 hours.
Just enough time to warm
out
up
right away.
The Cairo bombings from this morning. Who's responsible for them?
Well, it's likely to be the Muslim Brotherhood or an offshoot of Muslim Brotherhood. Certainly the people in Egypt are going to blame the Muslim Brotherhood. I don't believe it's the government that did this, because their interest right now is in stability following the passage of the Constitution, the upcoming election for president. So their interest is not to have this kind of disruption. And you see the angry reaction on the streets and the calling for... killing or going after the Muslim Brotherhood. So I think the likelihood is it, but it's not a conclusion you can draw now, because there are enough other groups operating in the Sinai, including Al-Qaeda linked groups, that could carry out such an attack.
So essentially, they had their chance, right? The Muslim Brotherhood essentially had their chance. If they would have handled things a bit differently, they could still be in the influential position of leading Egypt at this point. And they lost that opportunity, and now they're angry about that. And they see that Egypt is heading, I don't know if you'd agree with this, you'll tell me, is heading toward a somewhat more of a stable situation, constitution, upcoming elections, etc., and they're angry about that.
Well, I wouldn't say stable in regard to Egypt. Well, first of all, you're right, they blew the opportunity when Morsi was elected, and they had command of all of the elements of government. They could have done what they wanted. They replaced the leadership of the army. They took over all the key ministries.
Right.
And they overplayed their hand. And they never represented a majority. A lot of this, as we discussed at the time, were really false figures in the sense of the percentage of people who voted, the feeling of the rural areas, etc. And, I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood had perhaps 25%, 20% of the following. The government under al-Sisi has effectively moved to decapitate the movement, to arrest many of the members and to of the leadership, and to quiet down the movement. It hasn't disappeared. It's going to be there. They can cause a lot of problems, but the stability will only come when the economy reaches some much better level of productivity, when you have unemployment still running 40-50%, the 50% of people make less than $2 a day, and there's been no real turnaround.
Is it possible? I mean, I know it takes sometimes years, as we see in countries like ours, but is it possible that they could reach a point of economic stability?
It's possible, but it's not probable in the near future, and it's the instability there. They are still fighting against the elements in Sinai, and effectively doing so, but they have the second and third armies tied up there, or at least part of the third army. And also, they have been effective in Gaza, where the Hamas has said alone that they closed about 1,000 tunnels, and they have lost, a monthly income of about $240 million in taxes on the, quote, smuggled items, which is funny in and of itself. But the increased violence from there, and the possibility that Israel will have to take much stronger action when you've had 20 rockets fired into Israel in a short period of time, And in all of 2013, I think there were 40 altogether. So these 3 weeks into 2014, having have had half that total, and you remember when last week when six rockets were fired at at Ashkelon,
right.
And the Iron Dome prevented what could have been a major escalation, and Israel's gone back to targeting some of those responsible, hitting those who have fired these missiles. But they're making preparations all the time, Hamas, according to the reports, including test firing longer-range missiles, which because of the restrictions on imports, they are making now at home inside Gaza, M-75 rockets, which can unfortunately hit the middle of Tel Aviv and even to Jerusalem.
The Reuters report said Israel killed two Gaza terrorists in airstrike Wednesday, saying one of them was responsible for firing rockets across the border during Ariel Sharon's funeral last week.
And they're doing the same thing that Hezbollah, they're putting the rockets inside multi-story buildings or under them, and they have cameras on the top of minarets and water towers to gather intelligence, and they are building these underground tunnels, which cost about $1 million each.
Right.
So they always cry and complain that they have no money, and Israel is, you know, denying them income, et cetera, which is clearly not true. They're dependent on Israel today because Egypt has closed the crossings. This could be a front, and you see the continued incitement. You see that the and how the youth are being exhorted to violence, and this inevitably leads to an explosion.
Yeah, this is not a crying over spilled milk of disengagement, but you've always spoken about the domino effect of different things in the Middle East, and yet you'd have to admit, I think you're saying this, that things would likely be different if Israel, in fact, would not have given up control of whatever they did have control of in the Gaza Strip. I mean, you see how it's affecting, how Hamas taking over and terrorists in general taking over to the extent they have has affected the economy of Egypt, has affected the security of Egypt, and obviously has affected the increased rocket fire on Israel. But you see how even Egypt is suffering because of what happened there.
But Egypt has a much freer hand in being able to act. You know, the world doesn't hold Egypt accountable for carrying out the military actions against either in Sinai or in Gaza, as they do Israel. If Israel had closed all the access routes to Gaza, then you would have heard this wild outcry of indignation, et cetera. I mean, the same thing with the PA, the same thing we see in Iran. You know, you have hundreds and hundreds of executions,
right.
Wild since Rouhani's election, or the so-called moderate and the new face. And you see very tepid reaction. Finally, this the last couple of days, people have started talking about it because of the talks in Geneva. But in fact, it is not true. And the danger also you have is the spread of elements from within Gaza, let's say to the West Bank, or the report that that there was an attempt to bomb the U.S. embassy in Tel Aviv.
Mm-hmm.
First identified with an al-Qaeda group by some intelligence units. They were recruited, they said, in Gaza by al-Zawahiri, the inheritor of Osama bin Laden. And there were also going to be attacks on Binyanei Umah, the convention center in Jerusalem, simultaneous to the attack in Tel Aviv, and there were to be multiple attacks. They arrested three people there. Five were going to come in on fake Russian passports. So pretty sophisticated operation, but when you have the ability to recruit as you can in Gaza openly, and there also were other things, you know, where they found in Hebron two Palestinians who were arrested this week with a big weapons cache in their home, including the Uzi submachine gun and an M16 rifle. These are all things that can't just happen. You have to have some support system, even though obviously an individual can always acquire a weapon.
There was a Jerusalem Post article this morning that I saw that the United States officials are downplaying the plot to bomb the embassy. What's the value of that? Why not highlight what al-Qaeda was trying to do to the U.S. embassy in Tel Aviv?
Well, they are raising doubts, some questions about whether it is in fact al-Qaeda and whether this was a rogue operation. And that's something that only time will tell, and we have to find out more details. So I think that they're The warning is never to go too far ahead of the story, because when you have to pull it back, it's a lot harder. Also, you don't want to create panic. It's surprising how fast they reacted that way.
Yeah. How'd they find them, by the way? How'd they quell the operation?
I don't know.
I mean, that was a Shin Bet operation, I assume.
Yes.
Yeah. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, and around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Rough week in Israel, by the way. Tragedies all around with the pesticide deaths that we saw in Yerushalayim and the building explosion in Gilo. It was... keep hearing. I mean, you know, in the old days, you didn't hear everything till weeks or months later, if at all. You know, these days with the web, we're hearing the news that comes out of Israel and everywhere, and you know, we're immediately hit with so many bad episodes this week.
It is true, and it's the tragic situation with the pesticide, where I think people were using what was meant to be an industrial pesticide meant for the outside, because it reacts to open air. And they were using it in a home, and we'll have to find out whether that was negligence on the part of those who sold it, those who used it. But whatever, the tragedy is terrible.
Now, on the positive side, give us your overview of the Prime Minister of Canada and his visit to Israel. I wish members of our community spoke about Israel the way he does.
He said one sentence there, that either we stand up for the existence of a free, democratic, and distinctively Jewish state, or the retreat of our values and interests in the world will begin. And it's a message that, obviously resonated in Canada, although there were a lot of critics of him, and it's a very partisan situation generally in Canada about Harper. But his speech in the Knesset, the remarks of the foreign minister, and the attack on the delegitimization campaign, they're... You know, he started singing and playing instruments, at the dinner in his honor. So he has a future if he ever is not prime minister.
Well, I don't know if you saw the video like I did.
It wasn't so good.
Yeah, I don't know if you'd say he has a future in that area, but all right.
Right.
I'm praying that this trip didn't hurt him politically. Because it may be the only place where he'll still have a job.
Well, you'll play his records on Game and the
Do you think that it hurt him politically, this trip back home? I didn't even think of that.
He's seen as very pro-Israel, so in part, the numbers in Canada, by the way, on pro-Israel polls are not that good. In fact, more than a half of the Canadian people express negative views towards Israel. In part, that's the French sector and legacy, but in part, those who are against Harper, because he's so identified with Israel, express opinions that sometimes are hostile towards Israel. But Canada, as a rule, has been amazingly supportive. And you know that they lost the nomination for a seat on the Security Council because they were seen as too pro-Israel. At least that's the lore about it. But I know for sure that there's some truth to it. Whether it's the only reason or not, we don't know. But the Canada's assertiveness, and by the way, you hear it more from other people. When I was in Israel last week, the president of Sri Lanka was there. I doubt very much if many of your listeners know where it is or that it existed. It used to be called Ceylon, and it's a country in transition. And I met the president in September when he came to the United Nations. And in the discussion, he said, "So what do you think I should do?" I said, "Visit Israel." And sure enough, there he is. And I got invited to the state dinner, and he acknowledged it. But you see a country like that.
Now you got to go visit Sri Lanka.
Well, I'm absolutely going. And it's critical geopolitically. Anybody who will look on the map, just look below India. And it's a country that just emerged from a civil war against the Tamil Tigers and, you know, gets criticized for the human rights records rather than praised for the fact of how far they've moved the country.
Tatiana Edelstein passed away, wife of the Speaker of the Knesset. And I also noticed that Shulamit Aloni passed away. And the reason I noted is because when I was growing up, Malcolm, the symbol of everything that was wrong in Israel in my home was Shulamit Aloni. I mean, her name must have come up in any conversation having to do with those who are trying to harm Israel from the inside, quote unquote. You know what I mean. I'm being a little too harsh in the way I'm describing it. But certainly a figure that many people had to deal with in Israel.
Yeah, she's one of those legendary characters. She was heard on all the issues. I know full well what you're...
Yeah.
But the younger people here today wouldn't even know who she is.
Right.
She's 86 years old, I think.
Unbelievable. Yeah, definitely somebody who had an impact on my childhood as I was growing up. All right, so Israel is at the World Economic Forum, correct? Oh, by the way, I got to ask you this because you just mentioned it about the Security Council and Canada's possibility. To overstate the obvious, I hope I'm right, Israel's never been a member of the Security Council, correct?
Israel, no.
Okay. Do you know that a group of students toured the UN last week, high school students, and were told by the tour guide that it's likely that soon Israel will become a member of the Security Council? Now, is that ridiculous, or is there a possibility?
Israel has applied. You apply years in advance, and it's rotated amongst different, you know, different sectors. So Israel is part of the West European and Other group, which is one of the regional groupings. Each of those groupings nominates, I think, two candidates. The WEOC certainly nominates two candidates. And there's one that I think was assumed, and Israel was in line. This is, I think, for 2017 or later. And now Germany announced that it is a candidate for the seat, and obviously I think Germany would beat Israel in the vote. There was some support for Israel's potential membership on the Security Council. It would be a big boost.
So it's not crazy.
Not out of question.
Right, so it's not crazy. All right, very good. So, I mean, that's something, you know, sometimes sometimes we stress how other people should be doing our bidding. So it would be a good, you would hope that they would become a member of the Security Council, or it's better to stay off?
No, I think it's a recognition, and it would counter some of the isolationists, those who seek to isolate Israel. It means that you have to vote on issues and take decisions.
Right.
But countries vie for it.
Yeah, I guess it's very prestigious, that's for sure. That's one of the reasons that it piqued my curiosity when I heard they could possibly become a member. World Economic Forum. So what happens? Rouhani shows up, and he literally sits there like you'd be at an economic convention and tries to pitch business to different countries?
He tries to pitch business. He tries to give the impression of that they're breaking the isolation, and there are many groups going. The United States, in fact, now is trying to create a counter image of the erosion of the sanctions regime, and even made some public statements in the last few days about doing business with Iran. Administration officials increased their efforts to try and counter what is seen as a rush of companies and of delegations from various countries to go to Iran. In fact, they announced a $152 million settlement with Clearstream Banking, which is based in Luxembourg, and they're going to do other things, I think, to try and do some symbolic acts. But the fact is that Rouhani was well-received, even though his comments there contradicted everything that the administration had said, that he said that we're in negotiations with the U.S., and we want results, not words. He said that we're not going to dismantle a single centrifuge. We're not going to take down anything. Nothing will be destroyed. And he's fighting against the Iran Revolutionary Guard efforts against him in his own country, so he has to put on the show of toughness. But I think one should accept the fact that he's telling the truth. This is exactly what they believe and how they're approaching the deal right now.
So any shocks in terms of who agreed to meet with him at the forum?
Not that we know of now. But you saw this week how the foreign minister went too far, and then in regard to the Geneva talks on Syria, and said that, you know, they will not accept the removal of Assad. Then Ban Ki-moon had to rescind the invitation. That was a slap at them. but they're happy to sit on the sideline because they continue to play the role. They also see that the petrochemical sanctions are being lifted, the auto sanctions on auto parts, airplane parts, other things, all of which will boost the income and changes the mood at home. It doesn't have maybe as immediate a result in terms of huge jump in employment right away, but over time it will, and that bolsters their standing. And this idea keeps getting promulgated wider and wider that he is the moderate and he is the face of change. And we know, and if you listen to the statements, he still talks about the destruction of Israel. He talks about all the same, you know, terrible lines of Ahmadinejad, except he smiles when he does it.
Right. Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, met with the Chinese foreign minister at the forum. We know that the foreign minister was in Israel last month. But in general, how would you describe the Israel-China relationship?
It's budding. There are delegations every week. I met this week twice with people connected to China, interested in doing business, interested in expanding their ties. Just remember that when Israel and China together represent a market of 2 billion people,
yeah,
99% of that is Chinese. But
I think
they yeah. represent a huge opportunity, and they are crazy about Israeli technology. They see themselves as the Jews of Asia. They feel a cultural connection. They actually love to visit Israel. There are scores of graduate students from China studying in Israel. And you know that in most universities in China, there's a Jewish studies department.
I don't think I mentioned this last Friday. I think I mentioned it during our Tu B'Shvat special the day before. But I heard, number one, that there is a keen interest among the Chinese to purchase some of the largest companies of Israel. I mean, what I'm talking about in the billions and billions of dollars. And not just for the product that they might be making. If I told you the name of the brand, I think you'd be shocked. But not just for the product that they make, but for that technology, to be able to import what they do technologically in Israel in production of their products to China. And it's so forward-thinking. I mean, apparently, according to what I was told, there are technologies that take 20 years to develop that the Israelis can do in 2 years when it comes to food production. So the interest is just unbelievable. I don't think Netanyahu at this point has a choice but to try to forge an even better relationship with China, only because of the business that might be conducted between the two countries.
Well, as you know, they vote against Israel in the UN. They haven't become great friends in terms of the foreign policy, but in terms of the day-to-day relationship has really grown a lot. And what you just said is very significant. China has two great needs, food and energy. Mm-hmm. And they buy up any energy. That's why they deal with Iran, because they want to buy all the energy, and are now looking at Israel because of the new fines in Israel, and are trying to lock in, as are other countries, you know, on the energy that they were producing, the surplus that is expected to be exported. And the second need is food. You know that they have bought huge swaths of land in Africa, much to the consternation of African leaders, because they take everything and bring it back to China. They don't do it for the benefit of the people in Africa, and that they see it as purely exploitation. But one of the big issues is, like, post-harvest, to keep things from rotting and how you deal with it. That's a big issue for the Africans, and then I think for China. And they see in Israel, where they've made such great advances, or in the use of water. Israel this year will become water independent. That technology is something that the Chinese want. But beyond that, in terms of the high tech, much of manufacturing of those high tech products takes place in China. So it's a natural thing for them to want to buy into the companies, to invest. They want to do construction in Israel. They want to do joint ventures with Israelis.
Wow.
It means a lot. It's a huge market. They have a lot of money that they can apply, and at the same time, we know that they also deal with Israel's enemies.
Someone told me that celebrities in this country who are only, you know, mildly known in China want their biographies translated into Chinese, because if only the smallest of percentage of people in China buy the book, we're talking about millions of people buying it, because that's how many people are in China. So this market, this Chinese market, because of the numbers and their influence, is just going to get bigger and bigger.
There's in fact, a story just this week about one of the Israeli companies, I think it was called Evagene Seed Company, that uses biotechnology that creates plants that resist pests and different kinds of stress, and another one that monitors that produces monitors that maintain quality and consider they have things that deal with the needs of cows and everything else. Kalima is another company that was mentioned that increases the yield by 10 to 50%. And these are just a few of the amazing things. You know, we read about the other high-tech stuff, which is much more visible, either drugs or electronics.
Right.
But in fact, in the agricultural area, Israel has always been in the forefront with from drip irrigation to hydroponics, et cetera. But now these companies are doing amazing things.
And when you think about it, any forward-thinking company on the web has a Chinese website. And when you think about it, like the NBA has a Chinese website. You know, anybody who's even considering getting into that market.
Israel's not going to export any basketball players.
Well, that's likely true, yeah. All right, one chief rabbi or two. Do you have any strong opinion one way or the other as they propose that there should only be one chief rabbi in Israel?
Well, add to the unemployment, but that's an internal decision they have to make.
I mean, do you think it makes a difference?
Look, there was a reason why in the beginning, and you have, I think, some continuing reasons for it. There's a lot of work for them to do. But, I mean, this I don't think is something you can implement right away. It'll probably be done in time. But, I don't know enough to make a judgment.
Mayor de Blasio in New York defended New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo, who's come under endless criticism after telling a local radio station that extreme conservatives who are right to life, pro-assault weapon, or anti-gay, have no place in the state of New York. Now, I'm not here to go through each and every one of these categories with you in terms of who does or doesn't deserve, according to the governor or mayor, to be in New York. But, you know, when you see that someone comes out with such a strong statement, and right-to-lifers, and there are many right-to-lifers in our community, as you know, I'm not even going to talk about those who might be pro-assault weapons or those who are, I mean, nobody in our community, I don't think, is anti-gay, but there's certainly people in our community who are anti-gay marriage. So does this disturb you when you see the leader of New York City and New York State, the leaders, make a very, very harsh statement like this?
My field is international and national stuff. I don't do that much about New York. I do know about what they said. And I always think that harsh statements, when you heat up the rhetoric, it always has, every action has a counteraction.
Okay, I'll ask the question differently. Don't you think Jewish leadership in the city of New York and state of New York should have been more vocal once these statements were made?
People expected a stronger reaction or more visible reaction, I think, to some of the statements and some of the actions of others. You know, we've had members of Congress, one who represents a district with a significant Jewish population that was pictured with Farrakhan and Rouhani. It turns out he wasn't even aware of it because I confronted him yesterday about it. But, you know, the fact that you don't get reaction when things like this happen, it only further exacerbates the problems that we're going to confront in the future. About the statements of the governor and the mayor, again, I'm looking at other things that, frankly, we have so many areas from the Ukraine and its implications for the Jews there to the rise of the Salafists, and you know, the domestic problems belong to other organizations.
On the subject of, we'll get to Ukraine in a minute, but on the subject first of the Olympics, so now there's an official video out with responsibility taken for the bombings from a few weeks ago and with threats that the Olympic Games are going to be terrorized in Sochi, Russia. So who's the, I know it's an Islamic group and Islamic groups who are angry at Russia for the way that they react to Islamic people in, you know, different countries around Russia. How seriously is this threat? I mean, is it possible they're going to be disrupting the Olympic Games with terror attacks?
Absolutely. We remember Munich. We remember many other attempts in other places, and here you have an organized group. This is a relatively remote area in Sochi, and these are active groups. It's not, I think, one centralized operation like an al-Qaeda group, but these are cells which link together I think they call it a family or they have some other name for it. And each cell operates independently, but they have a common leader, a guide that they look to. And Russia, as I've discussed many times, has its own Muslim problem, and part of what it does with Iran and elsewhere is to buy them off and to buy off the pressure, the external pressure, for what they do in terms of suppressing that population. And here they have this opportunity, and they warned them that if they brought the Olympics there, that they would carry out these activities. And supposedly there are three women already inside Sochi ready to act. So I think more than a third of the tickets haven't been sold.
And there are families that are saying they're not going to watch their own kids play in the Olympic Games.
Yeah, because the kids say they don't want to be distracted worrying about their families when they want to be focused on the games.
But you would never.
They're not so concerned about themselves. They think it's about the distraction.
But you would never encourage that. I mean, that's really caving into terrorism, right? Or terror threats.
Yeah, but you know what? Russia does so much to support terrorist groups that it comes home to roost, that nobody should think that they're invulnerable to it. And maybe because they believe they're vulnerable to it, they do what they do sometimes. But you see, even in Syria today, where Russians, dozens of Antonov planes, these are their transport planes, are bringing armored vehicles, et cetera, they continue to trade and are just signed a $150 billion deal with Iran. They work with other groups and in other countries. So this is terrorism coming home to roost, and I think that they have to look at the sources for this. You know, China has it too, by the way, in Xinjiang province, and they're fighting Islamists there. So it's, everybody is touched by it, and the Russians, by the way, turn to Israel. Israeli security services are helping them in trying to deal with the security situation.
Wow. And in the Ukraine, you mentioned, tell me how it is affecting the riots in Kiev or affecting the Jewish community of the Ukraine.
Well, as you know, there's been a rise of anti-Semitism in Ukraine of late, and there have been various manifestations and talks. Some of these riots have at times taken on tinges of anti-Semitism, but with the end of the talks, we saw the rise of these demonstrations increase. White House is threatening sanctions against the Ukraine. Some Jews were warning that the people should remain quiet, the community should not get involved in this. Other leaders have gotten involved, some because of their own political orientations from the past. It's not just something from now. So it does pose the potential, because any kind of disruption there can lead to increase in anti-Semitism. There was several stabbings. You remember a rabbi this past week, and a student, a young man, was attacked.
And that was in Kiev?
That was not in Kiev, but I'm saying in general in Ukraine. And in Kiev there has been an increase, and it was not something that was visible there for a long time. But certainly now it's becoming much more noticeable.
All right, have a safe trip to Israel. Monday you're in, you're at Auschwitz with the incredible group from the Knesset and, as you said, representatives of the U.S. government as well, International Holocaust Remembrance Day, and very anxious to hear next week.
Nahum, one thing I think we should mention, because we always talk about when all these attempts at delegitimization that we see, you know, the attacks on SodaStream, the attacks on Israel's legitimacy, challenging Israel's right. Again, Abbas raised all sorts of questions. And
I know what you're about to say.
And they find the oldest inscription ever in the Hebrew language.
Right.
Going back to the 10th century BCE to the time of Shlomo HaMelech. And, I mean, it's just so mind-blowing. I mean, people are worried about Justin Bieber getting arrested in Miami. And when you have a story like this, which gets so little notice, when you have it took them a long time to decipher it, and it deals with lower-class wine that they probably served to people who worked outside the temple or guards or other people in the area. But it shows the system that they had then, and it's in Hebrew. Now, when the United Nations takes up all these questions of the delegitimizing of Israel, saying we have no roots there, saying we have no connections to the place, when you see all of the campaigns to it, just cite this. It's irrefutable. And again, people, I hope on Shabbos, talk to your kids, go and read the story, and tell them the significance of this, of where we come from, all of our heritage. It's right there. I just, to me, an amazing story, and the antidote to any of the depressing and other stories We're here. We were there for all these hundreds of years, thousands of years, and we're going to be there.
100%. Malcolm, thank you so much. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Malcolm Honlein, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.